This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Weather extremes and uncommon danger are erupting around this warming world. We need a tough, investigative climate journalist. Enter former war correspondent, indie journalist, and author Dar Jamail. His latest book, The End of Ice, is the talk of the planet. From the Pacific Northwest, Dar Jamail, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be with you.
When George Bush, or was it Dick Cheney, ordered the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. sent big-name journalists there to send back approved reports from carefully guarded compounds. So why did you, as an American, make that dangerous journey to become an unembedded reporter during the Iraq occupation?
Like millions of other Americans, I was outraged and flabbergasted at the selling of the war, the lies from the administration that are clear to everyone now that it was a complete setup and the war was essentially an invasion for an oil grab. And after having engaged in the usual things that we're told to do in the United States to express our discontent and try to pressure the government, things like writing letters to senators and going to demonstrations and things like this, clearly that was not going to get the job done. And then, of course, it didn't. And once the war was launched, my outrage continued to grow as the body count continued to escalate. And I decided, well, one thing I could do was go over to Iraq and see what was happening and report on how the occupation was affecting the Iraqi people, because I felt like that was the kind of yawning silence coming from the corporate media in the U.S. So I decided to go try to fill that void.
And then sometime after your book about Iraq, Beyond the Green Zone, which I read at the time, how did the BP Deepwater Horizon spill around 2010 tip you towards environmental reporting instead?
Well, the seed of what was happening to the planet had been planted long before the Iraq War. In fact, I had moved up to Alaska and started spending a lot of time mountain climbing. And so back in 96, when I moved up there, I was immediately aware of receding glaciers and really dramatic weather patterns that were abnormal for the Arctic region. And so the seed had been planted, and that was there all through my Iraq reporting. And so I'd always known that I wanted to get back into covering the climate as a journalist. And so when the BP oil disaster occurred, that was my segue into environmental journalism, which very shortly after that, I dove into reporting on the climate.
The full title of your new book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And you do all that in the book. I love the book. And you said the reporting in this book has turned out to be far more difficult to deal with than the years I spent reporting from war-torn Iraq. That sounds very unusual. Why do you say that?
Well, not to discount the gravity of what I experienced in Iraq and what all the Iraqi people experienced under the brutal, devastating U.S. occupation of that country. It was extremely trying, but looking, really expanding the parameters of what the climate crisis means to the planet, to our species, literally every single person on the planet is directly impacted by this now, but also all of the other species on the planet. You know, we just recently got wind of the UN intergovernmental report showing now, in addition to being already in the sixth mass extinction event, a million other species are now headed for extinction at the current trajectory we're on. And for me, really taking all of that in and experiencing emotionally what this means to be on this living planet, to be a human being like all the rest of us, completely dependent upon the biosphere, and watching how rapidly it's changing and being degraded, the emotional impact of that, the psychological impact, and then now living in this daily as a reporter, it's like what other climate scientists are experiencing. It's a really, really challenging thing to kind of fold into my global perspective on, you know, how do we be on this planet now, knowing all of this devastation that's occurring and even accelerating.
And you went into a period of depression while researching the book?
I did. Actually, that had even started before I decided to work on this book, just from my original reporting when I was working for Al Jazeera English doing climate stories. I started really seeing how devastating the situation was and taking that in and trying to process it individually. And I started then periodically struggling with depression around it. And then certainly doing the research for The End of Ice, I was in a writer's retreat and out there compiling reports and pulling things together for the various chapters, and would regularly run up against overwhelm by what I was seeing happening across the planet and the trends that were happening. And, you know, knew then I needed to find a way to kind of work with and process this information and talk with friends about it, and if I was going to keep being able to moving forward on the book.
That happens to me when I'm working on stories. I have to suddenly walk out and dig a bunch of weeds out of the garden almost in anger, or walk down by the river and try and listen to what the river's telling me. And eventually I can come back to this desk and this microphone and start all over again.
I very much relate to that, Alex. I have similar habits here. I live on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, and fortunately live amongst a forest. And so I would regularly, when I would come back home from my field trips for my research trips for the book, I'd be writing things up and kind of hit that wall and just go outside and look at the trees and take a deep breath or go for a walk. And the other thing, which I did during the book and continue to do after it's been published, is regular trips up into the mountains. That's kind of my key place to tap into the earth and hit the reset button and get perspective again and find some solace. And that actually is what I hope that by writing the book, it would inspire the readers to do.
The other night, my wife and I were watching ABC News, which is a terrible news program. It's really more of a YouTube video feature thing, but they showed scientists going down to Antarctica to study the whales there to see what the whales could tell us about climate change. And that's the first time they mentioned climate change all through the show, or maybe all week. Why can't the mainstream media report the whole truth about the developing climate disaster?
It's a very important point. And we look at the denialism in this country. It's astounding. I mean, the United States is ranked third in all of the larger countries on the planet for having the largest amount of denialism. A significant percentage of Americans do not believe climate change is even happening. Actually, it's 5%, which is stunning when it's right before our eyes every day. And then there's another 13% that believe that the climate is disrupted, but that humans are not the cause. So add those up and you're looking at nearly one fifth of the country, following only Saudi Arabia and Indonesia as far as a leading country in denialism. And this is precisely because of the failure of the corporate media. Like you just mentioned, this one piece that you watched that did at least mention it, that's actually an anomaly, where up to now, most major media, because of their corporate funding, so much of it coming from fossil fuel interests or weapons manufacturers like GE or Boeing, et cetera, they have a financial stake in denying that this crisis is upon us because it's going to be bad for their profits. So certainly the media outlets that run their advertisements are prone to that kind of pressure.
And you publish really detailed regular articles at truthout.org. You have a really great use of the online media because you put links to everything that we can follow up with. What is Truthout and how did that get going?
Truthout was formed in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks in New York City, as a response to the corporate media. And it has evolved since then into one of the leading lefty news outlets online. We were actually the first ever online-only news organization to unionize and do a really fine job of reporting because we're 90% reader-supported. And the 10% of the grants that the organization accepts are not accepted by anybody that tries to have any kind of editorial sway over our reportage. So I've been very lucky to write for them because it's enabled me over the years to write the types of climate stories and do these climate dispatches that I file every month that are really a no-holds-barred revelation of here's the latest information, and it is this dire, and we're not going to pull any punches, and we're going to call it exactly as the scientific studies are reporting it.
The climate story seems to express itself differently everywhere we go. Why does an author writing about the end of ice travel to the Amazon?
Well, I wanted to cover as many of the frontline places where the impacts are happening the most dramatically. So it is a quite a variety, from going to the Amazon to report on biodiversity loss, to South Florida for sea level rise, to Glacier National Park in Alaska to cover what's happening with glaciers and ice fields around the world, to St. Paul Island and the Pribilofs in the middle of the Bering Sea. I have a chapter based on that trip just to show how indigenous communities are taking the impacts the first and often the hardest, because they're the ones living closest to the planet. In other places as well, but the Amazon specifically, I was lucky enough to get to go down to Camp 41, the most famous of the study camps run by famous biodiversity expert Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. He's sometimes referred to as the godfather of biodiversity, and spend time there to really reveal what this recent report just showed that I mentioned earlier, that so many species are now faced with the threat of extinction, and the Amazon being the most biodiverse place on the planet is already showing, and has been showing for decades, very, very troubling signs of that kind of loss.
Did you meet with Dr. Lovejoy?
I did. I got to spend a few days with him, and I included much of an interview that I did with him in the book. And you know, this is a man who since 1965 has been studying the Amazon, and his singular work is responsible for the conservation of a large percentage of the Amazon rainforest, at least up until now, with the terrible changes that's happened in the government with Bolsonaro being elected. And now that's under threat. But Dr. Lovejoy, that Camp 41 that he established as part of his network of forest fragmentation camps, that one camp alone is responsible for the production of over 700 peer-reviewed scientific studies.
What a gift to meet with Thomas Lovejoy in the Amazon. I interviewed him in February 2013, and I learned a lot from him. Who are some of the other remarkable people in your book? Just give us a couple of examples, Star.
Well, another one was Dr. Dan Fagry. He's a United States Geological Survey ecologist. He's been studying the glaciers in Glacier National Park for decades. And I made it a point in the book and was privileged to get to spend time with people like Dr. Lovejoy and Dr. Fagry and numerous others, most of them with decades of experience studying what they were studying and living where they were living. So they have a long-term intimate relationship with these places. And Dr. Fagry, for example, in Glacier National Park, had spent well over 25 years there. He's also the lead scientist in the Benchmark Glacier Study Program that USGS runs across the U.S., where they take a glacier in each region as a measurement device they can use to track how fast the glaciers in that entire region are melting away, since glaciers are seen as a canary in the coal mine of climate disruption. And he is very, very passionate about his work, was extremely welcoming to me coming out there, and went out into the field with me and was just very, very excited about the opportunity to share his knowledge with the outside world. As grim as it is, he was very, very open, which was very refreshing, as was Dr. Lovejoy, because so much of the scientific community now, due to funding pressures and especially what's happening in the Trump administration with overt censorship of climate disruption studies, these people are very, very outspoken and passionate about what they're doing, and they're not stopping.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, journalist and author Dar Jamail. We are working around his new book, The End of Ice. Last week, Dar, another punishing round of strong tornadoes hit the southern United States. It's just part of a long string of extreme storms that frightens people in Oklahoma, flooded folks in Houston again, and cut agricultural planting in some key Midwest states in half. What is your takeaway from what is going on in the southern states?
Well, those storms specifically, specifically referencing the extreme flooding in the Midwest, there was a study that came out in the wake of that that showed that was a direct result of abnormal warming in the eastern Pacific that's tied directly to human-caused climate disruption. So there are direct links to all of these extreme weather events to one degree or another that tie them to human-caused climate disruption. Another recent study just in the last couple of weeks showed that these extreme weather events in the Houston region, like what we've just seen over the last few weeks, are also, of course, tied from a warmer atmosphere, which can hold that much more water vapor. It sets up these storms that then are releasing these record-breaking amounts of rainfall now on a regular basis. So you have these 100, 500, even 1,000-year, so-called 1,000-year storms that are now happening sometimes annually. One of those types of storms are now happening, and I would cite Hurricane Harvey as the most dramatic recent example.
Yes, new science from the University of Oxford finds strange new weather is becoming the normal, not just in America, but in many places. The paper was led by Kai Kornhuber, and it's published April 26th in Environmental Research Letters. Let me just read the brief abstract from that paper. Here we go. The summer of 2018 witnessed a number of extreme weather events such as heat waves in North America, Western Europe, and the Caspian Sea region, and rainfall extremes in Southeast Europe and Japan that occurred near simultaneously. Here we show that some of these extremes were connected by an amplified hemisphere-wide wave number 7 circulation pattern. We show that this pattern constitutes an important teleconnection in Northern Hemisphere summer associated with prolonged and above-normal temperatures in North America, Western Europe, and the Caspian Sea region. This pattern was also observed during the European heat waves of 2003, 2006, and 2015, among others. We show that the occurrence of this Wave 7 pattern has increased over recent decades, and that's just part, Dar, of a bunch of reporting that's coming out now saying, look, these are patterns that may be setting in at least for the medium term, maybe for the next few decades that we should expect. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm really grateful to hear that study and that report because it really underscores the deep interconnectivity of all of these systems. And this is an important thing for people to understand as we talk about climate disruption and the impacts and as everything's accelerating and intensifying. So this also underscores the feedback loops, you know, the most famous of which being that as we lose the summer Arctic sea ice, that, of course, reduces the albedo effect so that less solar radiation and warmth are being reflected back into space and instead absorbed into the ocean, which warms, which amplifies and accelerates the melting, which reduces the albedo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As Dr. Dan Fagry, I think, more summarily expressed how feedback loops work, he said, simply, the more something happens, the more something happens. And that interconnectivity is what makes this all possible. So to think that, for example, we can warm up the Arctic at more than twice the pace of the rest of the planet and that all the permafrost that starts to thaw up there is not going to have an impact on us, well, just look at the Arctic vortex and what's already happening with the temperature destabilizations across not just the Arctic but the rest of North America, which is making the jet stream so much more pliable and wavy and causing these Arctic vortexes. So again, if you change something dramatically in one part of the planet, it's going to have wide-ranging ripple effects across everywhere.
The Canadian scientist and YouTube climate teacher and Radio Ecoshock guest Paul Beckwith has been talking about waves in a stalled jet stream for years. This new Oxford paper seems further proof that Paul was right on the right track. But it sounds like patterns of land and seas in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, are starting to form relatively predictable zones of extreme weather. And I wonder if we're starting to see what the new normal will look like, as I say, for at least for the next few decades. I don't know about centuries from now, but maybe this is what people in the Northwest should look for is fire, and people in Houston should look for floods, and people in England will see abnormal summer weathers and the Caspian's going to be really hot. Maybe we're starting to peer into the future.
I think we're already there, Alex. I think that what's happening now is only going to keep intensifying. And you know, it's obvious. I mean, anyone that really tracks the projections that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been putting out and how every 7 years, each of their new assessments show that there's this consistent trend of all of these projections being having to raise upward to keep a pace with reality. And in fact, right now as we speak, for example, the worst case IPCC projections for loss of Arctic sea ice are less than what the observational reality is. So their worst case projections often are not even keeping a pace with observational reality. And that's why when, you know, I live in the Pacific Northwest, I've come to accept here that the recent summers, the last three in a row where we've had sometimes weeks on end, even west of the Cascades, of just consistent days filled with wildfire smoke from either fires in Washington or from British Columbia or Montana, or sometimes even those as far south as Southern California, that I've just come to accept that this is now, okay, it's smoke season. At some point this summer, we're going to have really dramatic smoke, and each of us is going to get to dance with various forms of respiratory problems. And same with down in Houston. You know, you mentioned the flooding, that what they're seeing now, what they're going to see through hurricane season, and of course well into the fall, these extreme flood events are going to become more and more common. And there's ample scientific studies showing this, whatever the extreme weather events in whichever region of the planet we're talking about, they're all tied directly or indirectly to climate disruption, and they're all sloping upwards as far as how severe they're going to be and how frequent they're going to occur. And we all need to start thinking about that in whichever region we live in and adapt accordingly.
I suppose if we were to decide where to live now, it means choosing your climate-driven poison. I mean, would listeners prefer worrying about forest fires, floods, hurricanes, droughts, or the rising seas flooding the main street of town? Most places seem to have their new threat, or are there safe zones left, do you think, like maybe New Zealand or Alaska or Canada's Yukon?
Well, there's certainly going to be impacts to deal with everywhere that you live on the planet, even those regions that you just mentioned. But those regions you mentioned are certainly going to have less extreme impacts. So that's why, for example, there's several billionaires from the U.S. and other countries around the globe that have bought up land and houses and constructed bunkers even on the South Island of New Zealand. In other places around the world, like Tasmania, where it's expected if you run the models out to the bitter end that some people even believe these could well be some of the last habitable areas on the planet if current trajectories continue. That said, it is very, very clear to look at the projections and say, well, the southwestern United States is going to be an increasingly challenging place to live due to record heat waves, wildfires and droughts. Water availability is going to be a major, major issue as compared to, for example, where I live on the Olympic Peninsula or up into British Columbia. If you're on the coast, this is going to be one of the better places to live because temperature spikes are going to be somewhat tempered by being in a maritime climate. And while there is ocean acidification and wildfires and other climate-related issues that are going to intensify, all of that is relatively tempered by proximity to the Pacific and in our latitude. But regardless of that, wherever we live, even in some of these so-called better places, like I just mentioned, there are going to be refugee issues. There are going to be water and food shortages. So it's not going to be a cakewalk wherever we are.
Yes, Dr. James Lovelock raised a bit of a furor a few years ago when he suggested that Britain might be a safe island in the climate storm due to being surrounded by oceans and its latitude. And so the British government should spend a lot of money developing new schools and hospitals for the millions of people who would flee to those islands. And that's the last thing that the Brexit folks want to hear about. So I don't know. There's a lot of very difficult issues. Maybe even Trump's southern border wall has a little bit of a climate tinge to it.
I think it probably does. Despite the rampant denialism in that administration, the fact is, if you look at the Pentagon's Quadrennial Defense Review Report, this is what they release every year, where they discuss their assessment of what are the biggest threats on the planet. And now for over 10 years, I remember it was back in, if I remember correctly, 2006, the Quadrennial Defense Review Report stated then that climate disruption and its impacts are going to be one of the biggest security threats for the Pentagon to deal with moving forward. And more recently, they have flat out said it is the single biggest security threat on the planet, precisely because of what you just mentioned, refugee crises, people coming into the country because the United States from the, coming up from the south. Because if you look at the climate projections, we're already seeing this happening now. Central America is going to be a very challenging place for farmers because of droughts, because of floods, because of other weather extremes and intensifying storms. And so a lot of these people that are coming to our southern border are people literally that just can't find food. They don't have work anymore because their farms, the inability to grow food and lack of support from the government to continue. And so this is a crisis. And it's well known, for example, that the Arab Spring that started back in 2011, that one of the ignition factors for that was a chronic drought across the region, escalating food prices, lack of assistance from the governments, and then people started to rebel because they literally couldn't afford food. And I think one important question just to file in the back of your head moving forward is, at what point does that start to happen more broadly across developed Western countries like the United States or Canada, because we're seeing this incredible flooding in Ontario and in the Midwestern United States, where, as you mentioned earlier, key crops haven't been planted or are severely delayed. So we're going to see these escalating food prices, and that's certainly going to have a political impact as well.
I noticed the new paper from Kornhuber at Oxford is all about the Northern Hemisphere, and the jets in the Southern Hemisphere are different. They are tightening closer to Antarctica and taking some rains with them away from Australia and from South Africa. It's sad to see how little science and weather reporting we get from South America, from Africa, and really anywhere south of the equator. I mean, the town of Apari in northern Philippines received an extreme danger heat warning 2 weeks ago. The heat index hit 57.6 degrees Celsius, or 135 degrees Fahrenheit, with 95% humidity. But the people in our countries with historic high fossil fuel emissions never hear about that. Dar Jamil, why do you think we have a big blind spot on this single world?
I think it ties back in to what we discussed earlier with the corporate media, particularly in the United States, is what I'm talking about now, where there is essentially a blanket policy, unwritten or not, that we are not going to report accurately on the gravity of this crisis. And in these places, the example you just gave is a perfect example. These really extreme events that they're happening, and if we don't report on them, then we don't have to talk about the climate crisis. And in the U.S., for example, we'll have this extreme flooding, and we'll have these amazing tornadoes that we've been witnessing lately, record-setting storms that are resulting in death and tens of billions of dollars in damages. But even most of those stories, they have to obviously report on them when they're happening right there on your front door. But they're rarely tied to the climate crisis that we're in. And so I think that's why when we look at what's happening in Bangladesh with storms there, cyclones hitting, and the ongoing and worsening refugee crisis, or what happened in Mozambique with record-setting cyclones and hundreds of deaths, and when two cyclones hit within weeks of one another, that you're not going to hear about that very often in the corporate media. And if you do hear about it again, it's just not going to be tied directly to the climate crisis because of why we discussed.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with my guest, Dar Jamil, climate reporter and author of the sensational book, The End of Ice. A supporter at StopFossilFuels.org has been posting Radio EcoShock interviews as YouTube videos, and I appreciate that help. But one commenter accused me of lying and misleading people when I repeated science from a recent guest Dr. David Keelings is an atmospheric scientist who told us climate change cannot cause a hurricane or a tropical cyclone. The hotter seas and water-laden atmosphere, sure, they can make those storms much, much worse once they start. But the climate, he says, isn't the original cause of the spin that becomes a cyclone. And it seems now that climate change is affecting so much, we can make the mistake of attributing absolutely everything bad to global warming. Dar, have you run into that too?
I have, and it's caused me to be very specific in my reporting in saying that, as I mentioned earlier, when I talk about an extreme weather event and try to always remember to mention that climate disruption has either a direct or indirect impact on it. But climate happens, it always has, it always will, it always changes. And what we're seeing is that it's being disrupted, amplified, accelerated, et cetera. But it's never factually correct to say that any climate event is solely caused by climate disruption. That's just simply scientifically inaccurate.
Some people worry the economy will crash as weather violence, rising seas, and other stresses just break civilization down. I worry this fossil economy will not break down until we wreck everything beyond any hope of repair. Dar Jamil, where do you fall on that spectrum?
I share your worry, Alex. I think that the fossil fuel economy can't end fast enough. Every day that it happens, and again, we see 2018 being yet another record emissions year for the planet of CO2 emission into the atmosphere. And so the faster this ends, the better. But then how is that going to come to be? I mean, if we had sane global governments, we would already be seeing dramatic shifts away from fossil fuels, not on 10, 20, or 30-year timelines, as so many governments are talking about, but literally in a matter of single-digit years, and taking the dramatic steps necessary for mitigation as well as ceasing the CO2 emissions, but using natural geoengineering, if you will, things like soil regeneration, planting trees, reestablishing massive acreages of wildlands across the planet so that natural sequestration can start being given a chance to take hold. These kinds of things. Instead, we're looking at the chronic, perpetual, growth at all costs, global capitalist economy that's literally consuming the planet. And so we're setting ourselves up for a collapse of civilizations instead of a softer transition that would have been possible or could have been possible. So we have people like Jim Bendel and his paper, Deep Adaptation, which I'm sure you've read, Alex, where he's kind of seen as being radical for stepping out and saying, yes, collapse is inevitable. And I would agree with him in that. And also add that he's not the first to say that there even several years ago was a NASA study that was published that showed at current trajectories without dramatic changes in the economy and how things are being done, we will see a collapse of civilization. The only question is when.
Yeah, the atmospheric scientist from Utah, Tim Garrett, also said that on Radio EcoShock back around 2010, that this energy economy is really a heat machine and that it must break down. There's just, for reasons of physics, it will break down. Drawing on what you saw in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, do you expect military confrontation and wars to be part of the coming climate story?
Well, I think it's inevitable. And again, I mentioned that Pentagon Quadrennial Defense Review Report where they're gearing up for it. They're preparing for refugee crises that will destabilize countries, possibly even Western countries. And then what would happen in the wake of that? They're concerned about going out and projecting force into the Arctic as the sea ice goes away. There's now a race between the U.S. and Russia and several other countries for who can get up there and try to acquire drilling and those resources. As insane and immoral as that is essentially what they're preparing for. And as food shortages continue to become more rampant and lack of potable water as well, the military is also preparing to deal with the crisis that are going to follow those things unraveling.
It used to be every month or so I'd have some startling new understanding of something unexpected in climate breakdown, and then it sort of became every week, and now I have to filter through them every couple of days. Have there been stories that are jaw-droppers for you recently, Dar Jamail?
Oh, gosh, I have that same experience, Alex. It's almost every day now it feels like another major study comes out that just feels like a gut punch to me, and I have to walk out and do what I mentioned earlier and look at the trees and remember to take some deep breaths. I think two of the big ones this year that have really had that kind of impact on me that off the top of my head are one being a study that came out in January. Lead author was Eric Rigno of University of California, Irvine, where it showed that melting across the Antarctic had increased sixfold since just the 1970s. And then his quote, where the New York Times interviewed him right when the study was published, and he said, quote, "Antarctica is melting away," end quote. And then the other study about the insect apocalypse showing that we were losing 2.4% of global insect biomass annually, and at current trajectories, assuming that doesn't accelerate, we're on track to functionally lose insect populations globally within 100 years. And that essentially means no more humans, because we literally couldn't live on the planet for very long without insects. When I read each of those, it was a showstopper for me. That's the kind of devastating information that really shows me and reminds me this is how far along we are in this climate crisis, and I literally am going to need a new ontology, a new philosophy of life to keep existing here and finding a way to do the work that I do to try to help the planet.
And we're going to get to that shortly. Now, another story that I'm trying to drum up interest here on Radio EcoShock, and I'm having difficulty finding scientists who can talk about this and get it across to the public in an interesting way, in a way that makes it immediate, and that is ocean warming. And I think this is huge. I think this is changing the planet, but it's not really in the newspapers. It's not really on TV much, and I don't know. Can you help me out? Is ocean warming that serious?
Well, I'm really glad you bring that up, Alex. I think it may well be the single most important and serious part of the climate crisis that we're in. And when I've done stories on this and talked with scientists studying what's happening in the oceans, they consistently say it's also, while they feel it's the most important part of this equation, that it's also the easiest to ignore because it's happening in the water and it's happening underwater, and most people never go out and look underneath the water or spend much time there. It's only a very small percentage of the human population that does. I mean, it's also not an accident that we've actually mapped more of the moon than we have the deep oceans. So that gives you an idea of how easy it is to ignore what's happening. And in reality is, the last 5 years, each succeeding year has been a record warm year for the oceans. And that trend is continuing, and it's happening right now this year as well. So this is extremely disconcerting. It's causing mass migration of marine species. It's as the oceans warm, they're now, of course, releasing more water vapor into the atmosphere, which is yet another feedback loop in the atmosphere further. And that, coupled with the acidification that happens in the oceans from there absorbing increasing amounts of CO2, this kind of 1-2 punch in the oceans is devastating. And that, coupled with overfishing and pollution and the plastic crisis there, we're literally deoxygenating, polluting, and warming and acidifying the oceans from which we came. And if you really think about that and think about what that entails for a little bit, and then think about what that means for our future, that also should give all of us great pause.
Well, before we go into how you might cope with all this knowledge, I just want to cover one last awful story. And I've said many times on the show that thawing permafrost is the awakening giant of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And lately, we've heard that it is happening, you guessed it, faster than anyone expected. How serious do you think permafrost thaw is, and is there a way to communicate that to the public that's still driving around in gas-guzzling SUVs and flying off to weddings in Fiji?
I dedicated an entire chapter of the book just to the thawing permafrost and the methane crisis in the subsea Arctic, because I feel that it's extremely critical that people understand what this means. So the permafrost contains vast amounts of organic matter that as it thaws, it releases huge amounts of CO2 and smaller amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Methane, of course, being a far more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2, roughly 85 times as potent on a 10-year time scale and still 20 times as potent on a 100-year time scale. So as the terrestrial permafrost thaws, and then as the Arctic Ocean warms and the subsea permafrost that contains the methane within it also thaws and starts to release that, which it is already doing, and that too is starting to accelerate, we are looking at a really, one could argue, the mother of all feedback loops, that there's enough carbon in the terrestrial permafrost and enough carbon equivalent in the methane in the subsea Arctic to easily more than double the amount of total CO2 we've ever emitted into the atmospheres. And this is starting to happen, and it's accelerating. And, of course, all of that warming is accelerating that comes from that, which, of course, accelerates the process further. So this is a huge crisis, and I've even seen it become severe enough that one of the scientists I interviewed for the book who used to be dramatically opposed to geoengineering was even starting to consider geoengineering as a way. He said, look, we have to find a way to keep the summer Arctic sea ice there no matter what, because once that goes, it's completely over and there's nothing we're going to be able to do to stop this planet going into complete, utter runaway. And while I'm not advocating geoengineering at all, I think that really underscores the severity of the crisis in the Arctic.
Radio EcoShock.
Okay, it's time to move to how we survive knowing what we know. And I think some of your coping mechanisms could help our listeners as well. On March 16, 2018, your talk, Update on the State of the Planet, How Then Shall We Live?, was recorded by California State University. You talked about Stephen Jenkinson, who helps people with palliative dying. Talking about climate change, Jenkinson said, if you awaken in our time, you awaken with a sob. Tell us about that, Dar. How does palliative dying have anything to do with the end of ice?
Well, Jenkinson is I find him to be a very compelling and brilliant author and thinker and storyteller. He is Canadian, and he worked in the palliative care industry for decades. And he gave a really deep talk at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver several years ago, talking in large part about the climate crisis and talking about accepting the fact that we were born onto this planet. He was sort of expressing a lot of indigenous philosophy that we were born onto this planet to be good stewards, and we have utterly failed in this task. We being industrialized global capitalist culture that is causing this crisis, and that we have to accept that and everything that comes with it. And the only way that we can start that is by grieving and really taking in deeply the gravity of the situation and being utterly honest with ourselves about the fact that we are in this crisis, and it's already to a point that not even the survival of the human species is a given anymore, that too is up for grabs, given the trajectory of things. And that means we are going to have to grieve, and we're going to have to, through the grieving process, really come to terms with this and then start letting that inform the decisions that we make in our lives. So if we understand that we may well be in a hospice situation on the planet, which is another way that I referred to it in the book, possibly even with our own species, certainly with other species, we know this as a fact, there are over 100 species a day going extinct on the planet. And that number, too, is starting to accelerate, according to that recent report I cited earlier. Then how are we going to live? Does it make sense to go just see how much money we can make? Does it make sense to keep abusing the planet in the ways that you mentioned earlier, the gas-guzzling ways? Or does it make sense to rededicate our lives to how can I try to save what's still here? What are my moral obligations to these young kids that are walking out of their schools in protest? Maybe I need to find ways to support them and find ways to be an elder and dedicate more of my time and energy to helping them prepare to live in this extremely harsh world that they're being left to grow up in.
And as soldiers returned from the endless Middle East wars, they were damaged and hurt inside. We all learned about post-traumatic stress disorder. For a while there, I thought we were developing pre-climatic stress disorder for those who know about the bad times yet to come. But now, of course, climate trauma is here, suffered directly by millions of people all over the world. I wonder if the recent turns towards far-right climate denialism, most recently in the surprising Australian elections, is that a symptom of a larger disease?
I think it is, Alex. I think that's a really fascinating point. And so when one of the things that's helped me when I see the denialism in the Trump administration or run into someone on the street who is a denialist and very vocal about it, I used to get extremely angry. And that, in fact, it would elicit a special kind of rage in me, given this blatant disregard, what I perceived as a blatant disregard for literally life on Earth. And instead, I started to kind of reframe it and look at it through the five stages of grief, the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross five stages of grief, where denial being the really essentially the first stage, that when, okay, you're faced with this possible loss of life of a loved one or your own, the average person's normal response is denial. Oh, this isn't really happening. And it's a coping mechanism, because to accept the gravity of it is so immediately overwhelming. And then after denialism, of course, become, you know, there's a, often a bargaining stage and then a depression and a couple of other stages, and it ultimately leads to acceptance, ideally. But when I look at these people, the denialism, for example, of what just happened with the Australia elections and the denialism across the United States and in the media, aside from the political and the financial causes of it that we discussed earlier, on an individual level, these people are simply unequipped or unable or unwilling to really deal with the emotional gravity of the situation that we're in, where we're literally in a situation where there may not be much left on Earth as things keep going the way that they are.
And on this topic, I recommend to listeners my program, Climate Denial is Human, with Dr. Varkey. Check that out, because he's got a really impressive theory about this. Now, it surprised me, Dar, when you said, don't try to fix the big picture. What do you mean?
Well, I think for a long time I was hoping that my reporting would contribute to that. And I realized in retrospect that I was consistently setting myself up for failure. And I would do a flurry of what I felt to be extremely important, groundbreaking stories, and then consistently see things only continue to change for the worse in the bigger picture, as far as lack of adequate government response or lack of more people really waking up the way I felt they should be waking up. And it only fueled depression and struggles with my own anxiety around what's happening on the planet. And I have found solace in instead waking up and just focusing on, okay, what can I do? And one of the people I talk about at the concluding chapter of my book is an indigenous elder named Stan Rushworth of Cherokee descent, who reminded me of moral obligations that the indigenous philosophy is that we are born onto the planet with moral obligations to take care of and serve the planet and to carry out all of our actions mindful of how those impacts would affect future generations. And so if I wake up each day thinking, what are my moral obligations today? What do I need to do to live my life towards those? How can I best serve the planet today? Then I have unlimited things in my imagination that I can do to help. And that's going to inform every decision that I make as far as how much I travel. Am I reducing my carbon footprint on a regular basis? How many young folks am I trying to figure out how I can help? How can I grow more of my own food? How can I write better or speak better to this topic to help more people? All of these things, and just doing that simply because it's the right thing to do, and trying to remind myself along the way to not be attached to the results.
That was a great list, and I'm right with you on that. And I noticed that you talk about either living right or living angry. And I wonder, do you meditate?
I do. I do. I meditate on a regular basis. When I'm in my better rhythm of things, it's a daily habit, because I found, Alex, and I imagine you've had a very similar experience given your show and how long you've been covering these topics, that if I'm not very diligent on a regular basis with self-care on the meditation front, time outside, eating right, taking time away from giving myself news breaks, staying offline on the weekends, et cetera, then it's very, very easy for me, and very quickly do I spiral back into the anxiety and depression that comes so easily during these times.
In your book, you found an amazing tree in the Olympic Mountains of Washington State that clings on to life in the most hostile high peak. I know it's almost popular to say humans will go extinct soon, but I think we are tough like that tree. Some people will hang on. Dar, what are your thoughts on humanity's ability to survive?
Well, you know, Alex, I'm really glad that you bring that up, because I have run into a lot of people that do seem kind of fixated and attached on humans going extinct. Almost some of them come off as though they want it to happen. And while I can understand the anger and frustration at the species, the industrialized version of the species, for causing so much death and destruction across the planet to all species, I still do believe that we are obliged to stay here and do what we can to try to make amends and rectify this crisis. Not that we're going to stop it or probably even mitigate it much, but again, I keep coming back to that moral obligation to stick around and try to clean up as much of the mess as we can. And I bring in the story of this tree high up in the Olympic Mountains. The tree line here is roughly 5,200 feet. And I was up on a mountain a little over 7,000 feet, and there's actually a fair-sized tree, this gnarly tree, growing out of this very thin crevice in a rock high up there, you know, in an area that 6 months of the year it's covered in snow and ice. Hurricane-force winds are a regular thing. This tree's not even supposed to be there, and yet there it is. And so I bring that in to kind of underscore how life, given the most minuscule chance, is going to persist. And humans are extremely resilient, and we are extremely adaptive. And I think given half the chance, we will find a way to be here. But I think that's only going to happen if we try to find that way in deepest relation to the Earth as possible.
Although your book research took you to the hot tropical forests and balmy Pacific Islands, you chose The End of Ice as your grand title narrative. Is ice the key?
Well, I do see it as a key. That's half the story. The other half of the story is personal bias, because my favorite places to go on the planet are always high up in mountainous regions where there's lots of ice and glaciers. But certainly, if we look at the fact that what happens when we lose glaciers and ice sheets and the impact that has on climate systems, as well as our own drinking and irrigation water and that of so many other species, I do see that as a critical, critical factor. And why, when I see these ongoing reports of how much faster the melting is accelerating across Antarctica, or the Western Antarctic ice sheet, or the Ross ice shelf, or Greenland, or land-based glaciers, it's extremely worrisome for me, because it seems hard to imagine that humans are going to be capable, as resilient as we may be, of living on a planet that does not have ice.
You began your book with a near-death experience on the glaciers of Mount Denali, the highest peak in North America, and listeners, you can hear Dar read that introduction at the Guardian website. I'll put links to that in my blog. Why begin with that personal story?
But that actually happened, just to be specific, on in a smaller mountain range up in Alaska. And I wanted to really include that story, though, because the experience I had of literally punching through a snow bridge while roped up with a partner, and then falling down into this crevasse and dragging him to the edge of it unwittingly, which we miraculously stopped falling at the last minute, and then hanging there. And you brought up meditation here, and it was really an acute version of me having to meditate on the ice that was right in front of me to kind of maintain my cool and give my climbing partners time to set up a pulley system with which to extract me from the dangerous position that I'd fallen into. And while I was there, and then as I was pulled up out of the crevasse, and then certainly as I reflected on the accident later, that I had this huge emotional response when I came up. Obviously, I was very, very relieved, and a lot of the trauma from the fall I was releasing through a lot of crying and then kind of roaring in gratitude for being alive and hugging my partners for getting me out of the fix that I was in. And then also I realized that it was also a grief that was coming out, because even then I knew before doing the deep research for this book that I was acutely aware of how much loss of ice was already occurring across Alaska and glaciers around the world. And that it was really, I think, one of my first experiences of the deep grieving process that has started and does continue for what's happening to the planet.
As we wrap up here, Dara, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
I think the thought that I'd like to leave people with is just that, which was my one hope from when I wrote this book, which is that when people read it, it has a lot of very intense, difficult information to take in. It's all the scientific facts of what's happening. But then simply to remember to go back out to whatever your favorite place is on the planet and reconnect to the planet in as deep a way as possible. Because I do believe that the fundamental root cause of the climate crisis is a Western civilization's disconnection from the planet. So before we can really make heartfelt, informed decisions on how to use this precious time that we have, I think we'd be best served to go connect deeply into the planet and let that inspiration come from that place.
We have been speaking with one of the most in-depth, independent climate reporters in the world. Dar Jamail posts at truthout.org, often appears on Democracy Now! TV, and just released the new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. It is a good read and important, and of course Dar includes 18 pages of notes to his sources. You can check them out all the way. You can connect with Dar Jamail at darjamail.net, or find links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Dar, I've been reading your work for years, sometimes getting story ideas for Radio EcoShock. It's been a pleasure finally meeting you here. Thank you for this conversation.
It was my great pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Next week, we explore the awful potential coming out of thawing permafrost, plus another new development in our climate shift. Back-to-back heat waves springing up all over the world. Don't miss it. My thanks to everyone who shares this show on social media, to those who tell their friends about this science. While we toss and turn in politics, our world is shaking loose into big changes that are off the public radar. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world?